She saw them as they went by, written on the walls of modest structures, over sooted roofs, down slender smokestacks, on the curves of tanks. Reynolds Harvesters, Macy Cement, Quinlan and Jones Pressed Alfalfa, home of the Crawford Mattress, Benjamin Wiley Grain and Feed. Words raised like flags to the empty darkness of the sky. The motionless forms of movement, of effort, of courage, of hope. The monuments to how much had been achieved on the edge of nature's void by men who had once been free to achieve. She saw the homes built in scattered privacy, the small shops, the wide streets with electric lighting, like a few luminous strokes crisscrossed on the black sheet of the wastelands. She saw the ghosts between, the remnants of towns, the skeletons of factories with crumbling smokestacks, the corpses of shops with broken panes, the slanting poles with shreds of wire. She saw a sudden blaze, the rare sight of a gas station, a glittering white island of glass and metal under the huge black weight of space and sky. She saw an ice cream cone made of radiant tubing hanging above the corner of a street, and a battered car being parked below, with a young boy at the wheel and a girl stepping out, her white dress blowing in the summer wind. She shuddered for the two of them, thinking, "I can't look at you. I who know what it has taken to give you your youth, to give you this evening, this car, and the ice cream cone you're going to buy for a quarter." She saw on the edge beyond a town, a building glowing with tiers of pale blue light, the industrial light she loved, with the silhouettes of machines in its windows and a billboard in the darkness above its roof. And suddenly her head fell on her arm and she sat shaking, crying soundlessly to the night, to herself, to whatever was human in any living being. "Don't let it go. Don't let it go." She jumped to her feet and snapped on the light. She stood still, fighting to regain control, knowing that such moments were her greatest danger. The lights of the town were past. Her window was now an empty rectangle, and she heard in the silence the progression of the fourth knocks, the steps of the enemy moving on, not to be hastened or stopped. In desperate need of the sight of some living activity, she decided she would not order dinner in her car, but would go to the diner. As if stressing and mocking her loneliness, a voice came back to her mind, "But you would not run trains if they were empty." "Forget it," she told herself angrily, walking hastily to the door of her car. She was astonished, approaching her vestibule, to hear the sound of voices close by. As she pulled the door open, she heard a shout, "Get off, goddamn you!" An aging tramp had taken refuge in the corner of her vestibule. He sat on the floor, his posture suggesting that he had no strength left to stand up or to care about being caught. He was looking at the conductor, his eyes observant, fully conscious, but devoid of any reaction. The train was slowing down for a bad stretch of track. The conductor had opened the door to a cold gust of wind and was waving at the speeding black void, ordering, "Get going, get off as you got on, or I'll kick you off head first." There was no astonishment in the tramp's face, no protest, no anger, no hope. He looked as if he had long since abandoned any judgment of any human action. He moved obediently to rise, his hand groping upward along the rivets of the car's wall. She saw him glance at her and glance away, as if she were merely another inanimate fixture of the train. He did not seem to be aware of her person any more than of his own. He was indifferently ready to comply with an order which, in his condition, meant certain death. She glanced at the conductor. She saw nothing in his face except the blind malevolence of pain, of some long-repressed anger that broke out upon the first object available, almost without consciousness of the object's identity. The two men were not human beings to each other any longer. The tramp's suit was a mass of careful patches on a cloth so stiff and shiny with wear that one expected it to crack like glass if bent. But she noticed the collar of his shirt. It was bone white from repeated laundering, and it still preserved a semblance of shape. He had pulled himself up to his feet. He was looking indifferently at the black hole open upon miles of uninhabited wilderness where no one would see the body or hear the voice of a mangled man. But the only gesture of concern he made was to tighten his grip on a small, dirty bundle, as if to make sure he would not lose it in leaping off the train. It was the laundered collar, and this gesture for the last of his possessions, the gesture of a sense of property that made her feel an emotion like a sudden burning twist within her. "Wait," she said. The two men turned to her. "Let him be my guest," she said to the conductor, and held her door open for the tramp, ordering, "Come in." The tramp followed her, obeying as blankly as he had been about to obey the conductor. He stood in the middle of her car, holding his bundle, looking around him with the same observant, unreacting glance. "Sit down," she said. He obeyed, and looked at her, as if waiting for further orders. There was a kind of dignity in his manner, the honesty of the open admission that he had no claim to make, no plea to offer, no questions to ask, that he now had to accept whatever was done to him, and was ready to accept it. He seemed to be in his early 50s. The structure of his bones and the looseness of his suit suggested that he had once been muscular. The lifeless indifference of his eyes did not fully hide that they had been intelligent. The wrinkles cutting his face with the record of some incredible bitterness had not fully erased the fact that the face had once possessed the kindliness peculiar to honesty. "When did you eat last?" she asked. "Yesterday," he said, and added, "I think." She rang for the porter and ordered dinner for two to be brought to her car from the diner. The tramp had watched her silently, but when the porter departed, he offered the only payment it was in his power to offer. "I don't want to get you in trouble, ma'am," he said. She smiled. "What trouble?" "You're traveling with one of those railroad tycoons, aren't you?"
"No, alone."
"Then you're the wife of one of them?"
"No."
"Oh."
Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, Part 2 continued.
Disc 3.
Chapter 10. The Sign of the Dollar. She sat at the window of the train, her head thrown back, not moving, wishing she would never have to move again. The telegraph poles went racing past the window, but the train seemed lost in a void between a brown stretch of prairie and a solid spread of rusty, graying clouds. The twilight was draining the sky without the wound of a sunset. It looked more like the fading of an anemic body in the process of exhausting its last drops of blood and light. The train was going west as if it, too, were pulled to follow the sinking rays and quietly to vanish from the earth. She sat still, feeling no desire to resist it. She wished she would not hear the sound of the wheels. They knocked in an even rhythm, every fourth knock accented, and it seemed to her that through the rapid running clatter of some futile stampede to escape, the beat of the accented knocks was like the steps of an enemy moving toward some inexorable purpose. She had never experienced it before, this sense of apprehension at the sight of a prairie, this feeling that the rail was only a fragile thread stretched across an enormous emptiness, like a worn nerve, ready to break. She had never expected that she, who had felt as if she were the motive power aboard a train, would now sit wishing like a child or a savage that this train would move, that it would not stop, that it would get her there on time, wishing it, not like an act of will, but like a plea to a dark unknown. She thought of what a difference 1 month had made. She had seen it in the faces of the men at the stations, the track workers, the switchmen, the yard men who had always greeted her anywhere along the line, their cheerful grins boasting that they knew who she was, had now looked at her stonily, turning away, their faces wary and closed. She had wanted to cry to them an apology, "It's not I who've done it to you," then had remembered that she had accepted it, and that they now had the right to hate her, that she was both a slave and a driver of slaves, and so was every human being in the country, and hatred was the only thing that men could now feel for one another. She had found reassurance for 2 days in the sight of the cities moving past her window, the factories, the bridges, the electric signs, the billboards pressing down upon the roofs of homes, the crowded, grimy, active, living conflux of the industrial East. But the cities had been left behind. The train was now diving into the prairies of Nebraska, the rattle of its couplers sounding as if it were shivering with cold. She saw lonely shapes that had been farmhouses and the vacant stretches that had been fields. But the great burst of energy in the east, generations ago, had splattered bright trickles to run through the emptiness. Some were gone, but some still lived. She was startled when the lights of a small town swept across her car, and vanishing, left it darker than it had been before. She would not move to turn on the light. She sat still, watching the rare towns. Whenever an electric beam went flashing briefly at her face, it was like a moment's greeting. She saw them as they went by, written on the walls of modest structures, over sooted roofs, down slender smokestacks, on the curves of tanks. Reynolds Harvesters, Macy Cement, Quinlan and Jones Pressed Alfalfa, home of the Crawford Mattress, Benjamin Wiley Grain and Feed. Words raised like flags to the empty darkness of the sky. The motionless forms of movement, of effort, of courage, of hope. The monuments to how much had been achieved on the edge of nature's void by men who had once been free to achieve. She saw the homes built in scattered privacy, the small shops, the wide streets with electric lighting, like a few luminous strokes crisscrossed on the black sheet of the wastelands. She saw the ghosts between, the remnants of towns, the skeletons of factories with crumbling smokestacks, the corpses of shops with broken panes, the slanting poles with shreds of wire. She saw a sudden blaze, the rare sight of a gas station, a glittering white island of glass and metal under the huge black weight of space and sky. She saw an ice cream cone made of radiant tubing hanging above the corner of a street, and a battered car being parked below, with a young boy at the wheel and a girl stepping out, her white dress blowing in the summer wind. She shuddered for the two of them, thinking, "I can't look at you, I who know what it has taken to give you your youth, to give you this evening, this car, and the ice cream cone you're going to buy for a quarter." She saw on the edge beyond a town, a building glowing with tiers of pale blue light, the industrial light she loved, with the silhouettes of machines in its windows and a billboard in the darkness above its roof. And suddenly her head fell on her arm and she sat shaking, crying soundlessly to the night, to herself, to whatever was human in any living being. "Don't let it go. Don't let it go." She jumped to her feet and snapped on the light. She stood still, fighting to regain control, knowing that such moments were her greatest danger. The lights of the town were past. Her window was now an empty rectangle, and she heard in the silence the progression of the fourth knocks, the steps of the enemy moving on, not to be hastened or stopped. In desperate need of the sight of some living activity, she decided she would not order dinner in her car, but would go to the diner. As if stressing and mocking her loneliness, a voice came back to her mind, "But you would not run trains if they were empty." "Forget it," she told herself angrily, walking hastily to the door of her car. She was astonished, approaching her vestibule, to hear the sound of voices close by. As she pulled the door open, she heard a shout, "Get off, goddamn you!" An aging tramp had taken refuge in the corner of her vestibule. He sat on the floor, his posture suggesting that he had no strength left to stand up or to care about being caught. He was looking at the conductor, his eyes observant, fully conscious, but devoid of any reaction. The train was slowing down for a bad stretch of track. The conductor had opened the door to a cold gust of wind and was waving at the speeding black void, ordering, "Get going, get off as you got on, or I'll kick you off head first." There was no astonishment in the tramp's face, no protest, no anger, no hope. He looked as if he had long since abandoned any judgment of any human action. He moved obediently to rise, his hand groping upward along the rivets of the car's wall. She saw him glance at her and glance away, as if she were merely another inanimate fixture of the train. He did not seem to be aware of her person any more than of his own. He was indifferently ready to comply with an order which, in his condition, meant certain death. She glanced at the conductor. She saw nothing in his face except the blind malevolence of pain, of some long repressed anger that broke out upon the first object available, almost without consciousness of the object's identity. The two men were not human beings to each other any longer. The tramp's suit was a mass of careful patches on a cloth so stiff and shiny with wear that one expected it to crack like glass if bent. But she noticed the collar of his shirt. It was bone white from repeated laundering, and it still preserved a semblance of shape. He had pulled himself up to his feet. He was looking indifferently at the black hole open upon miles of uninhabited wilderness, where no one would see the body or hear the voice of a mangled man. But the only gesture of concern he made was to tighten his grip on a small, dirty bundle, as if to make sure he would not lose it in leaping off the train. It was the laundered collar, and this gesture for the last of his possessions, the gesture of a sense of property that made her feel an emotion like a sudden, burning twist within her. "Wait," she said. The two men turned to her. "Let him be my guest," she said to the conductor, and held her door open for the tramp, ordering, "Come in." The tramp followed her, obeying as blankly as he had been about to obey the conductor. He stood in the middle of her car, holding his bundle, looking around him with the same observant, unreacting glance. "Sit down," she said. He obeyed, and looked at her, as if waiting for further orders. There was a kind of dignity in his manner, the honesty of the open admission that he had no claim to make, no plea to offer, no questions to ask, that he now had to accept whatever was done to him, and was ready to accept it. He seemed to be in his early 50s. The structure of his bones and the looseness of his suit suggested that he had once been muscular. The lifeless indifference of his eyes did not fully hide that they had been intelligent. The wrinkles cutting his face with the record of some incredible bitterness had not fully erased the fact that the face had once possessed the kindliness peculiar to honesty. "When did you eat last?" she asked. "Yesterday," he said, and added, "I think." She rang for the porter and ordered dinner for two to be brought to her car from the diner. The tramp had watched her silently, but when the porter departed, he offered the only payment it was in his power to offer. "I don't want to get you in trouble, ma'am," he said. She smiled. "What trouble?" "You're traveling with one of those railroad tycoons, aren't you?"
"No, alone."
"Then you're the wife of one of them?"
"No."
"Oh."
She saw his effort at a look of something like respect, as if to make up for having forced an improper confession. And she laughed. "No, not that either. I guess I'm one of the tycoons myself. My name is Dagny Taggart, and I work for this railroad."
"Oh. I think I've heard of you, ma'am, in the old days."
It was hard to tell what the old days meant to him, whether it was a month or a year or whatever period of time had passed since he had given up. He was looking at her with a sort of interest in the past tense, as if he were thinking that there had been a time when he would have considered her a personage worth seeing.
"You were the lady who ran a railroad," he said.
"Yes," she said, "I was." He showed no sign of astonishment at the fact that she had chosen to help him. He looked as if so much brutality had confronted him that he had given up the attempt to understand, to trust, or to expect anything. "When did you get aboard the train?" she asked.
"Back at the division point, ma'am. Your door wasn't locked."
He added,
"I figured maybe nobody would notice me till morning on account of it being a private car."
"Where are you going?"
"I don't know."
Then, almost as if he sensed that this could sound too much like an appeal for pity, he added,
"I guess I just wanted to keep moving till I saw some place that looked like there might be a chance to find work there."
This was his attempt to assume the responsibility of a purpose, rather than to throw the burden of his aimlessness upon her mercy. An attempt of the same order as his shirt collar. "What kind of work are you looking for?"
"People don't look for kinds of work anymore, ma'am," he answered impassively. "They just look for work."
"What sort of place did you hope to find?"
"Oh, well, where there's factories, I guess."
"Aren't you going in the wrong direction for that? The factories are in the east."
"No."
He said it with the firmness of knowledge.
"There are too many people in the east. The factories are too well watched. I figure there might be a better chance someplace where there's fewer people and less law."
"Oh, running away. A fugitive from the law, are you?"
"Not as you'd mean it in the old days, ma'am.
But as things are now, I guess I am. I want to work.
What do you mean?
There aren't any jobs back east. And a man couldn't give you a job if he had one to give. He'd go to jail for it. He's watched. You can't get work except through the Unification Board. The Unification Board has a gang of its own friends waiting in line for the jobs. More friends than a millionaire's got relatives. Well, me, I haven't got either.
Where did you work last?
I've been bumming around the country for 6 months. No, longer, I guess. I guess it's closer to about a year. I can't tell anymore. Mostly day work it was, mostly on farms. But it's getting to be no use now. I know how the farmers look at you. They don't like to see a man starving, but they're only one jump ahead of starvation themselves. They haven't any work to give you, they haven't any food, and whatever they save, if the tax collectors don't get it, then the raiders do. You know, the gangs that rove all through the country. Deserters, they call them.
Do you think that it's any better in the West?
No, I don't.
Then why are you going there?
Because I haven't tried it before. That's all there is left to try. It's somewhere to go, just to keep moving.
You know, he added suddenly,
I don't think it'll be any use, but there's nothing to do in the East except sit under some hedge and wait to die. I don't think I'd mind it much now, the dying. I know it would be a lot easier, only I think that it's a sin to sit down and let your life go without making a try for it.
She thought suddenly of those modern college-infected parasites, who assumed a sickening air of moral self-righteousness whenever they uttered the standard bromides about their concern for the welfare of others. The tramp's last sentence was one of the most profoundly moral statements she had ever heard. But the man did not know it. He had said it in his impassive, extinguished voice, simply, dryly, as a matter of fact. What part of the country do you come from? She asked.
Wisconsin, he answered.
The waiter came in, bringing their dinner. He set a table and courteously moved two chairs, showing no astonishment at the nature of the occasion. She looked at the table. She thought that the magnificence of a world where men could afford the time and the effortless concern for such things as starched napkins and tinkling ice cubes, offered to travelers along with their meals for the price of a few dollars, was a remnant of the age when the sustenance of one's life had not been made a crime, and a meal had not been a matter of running a race with death. A remnant which was soon to vanish, like the white filling station on the edge of the weeds of the jungle. She noticed that the tramp, who had lost the strength to stand up, had not lost the respect for the meaning of the thing spread before him. He did not pounce upon the food. He fought to keep his movements slow, to unfold his napkin, to pick up his fork in tempo with hers, his hand shaking, as if he still knew that this, no matter what indignity was ever forced upon them, was the manner proper to men. What was your line of work in the old days? She asked when the waiter left. Factories, wasn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
What trade?
Skilled lathe operator.
When did you work at it last?
In Colorado, ma'am, for the Hammond Car Company.
Oh.
Ma'am?
No, nothing. Worked there long?
No, ma'am. Just 2 weeks.
How come?
Well, I'd waited a year for it, hanging around Colorado just to get that job. They had a waiting list, too, the Hammond Car Company. Only they didn't go by friendships, and they didn't go by seniority. They went by a man's record. I had a good record. But it was just 2 weeks after I got the job that Lawrence Hammond quit. He quit and disappeared. They closed the plant. Afterwards, there was a citizens' committee that reopened it. I got called back, but 5 days was all it lasted. They started layoffs just about at once, by seniority. So I had to go. I heard they lasted for about 3 months, the citizens' committee. Then they had to close the plant for good.
Where did you work before that?
Just about in every eastern state, ma'am. But it was never more than a month or two. The plants kept closing.
Did that happen on every job you've held? He glanced at her, as if he understood her question.
No, ma'am, he answered.
And for the first time she caught a faint echo of pride in his voice.
The first job I had? I held it for 20 years. Not the same job, but the same place, I mean. I got to be shop foreman. That was 12 years ago. Then the owner of the plant died, and the heirs who took it over ran it into the ground. Times were bad then, but it was since then that things started going to pieces everywhere, faster and faster. Since then, it seems like anywhere I turned, the place cracked and went. At first, we thought it was only one state or another. A lot of us thought that Colorado would last, but it went too. Anything you tried, anything you touched, it fell. Anywhere you looked, work was stopping. The factories were stopping. The machines were stopping. He added slowly in a whisper, as if seeing some secret terror of his own. The motors were stopping. His voice rose. Oh, God, who is... and broke off.
John Galt? She asked.
Yes, he said, and shook his head as if to dispel some vision. Only I don't like to say that.
I don't either. I wish I knew why people are saying it and who started it.
That's it, ma'am. That's what I'm afraid of. It might have been me who started it.
What?
Me or about 6,000 others. We might have. I think we did. I hope we're wrong.
What do you mean?
Well, there was something that happened at that plant where I worked for 20 years. It was when the old man died and his heirs took over. There were three of them, two sons and a daughter, and they brought a new plan to run the factory. They let us vote on it, too, and everybody, almost everybody, voted for it. We didn't know. We thought it was good. No, that's not true, either. We thought that we were supposed to think it was good. The plan was that everybody in the factory would work according to his ability, but would be paid according to his need. We... What's the matter, ma'am? Why do you look like that?
What was the name of the factory? She asked, her voice barely audible.
The 20th Century Motor Company, ma'am, of Starnesville, Wisconsin.
Go on.
We voted for that plan at a big meeting with all of us present, 6,000 of us. Everybody that worked in the factory. The Starnes heirs made long speeches about it, and it wasn't too clear, but nobody asked any questions. None of us knew just how the plan would work, but every one of us thought that the next fella knew it. And if anybody had doubts, he felt guilty and kept his mouth shut. Because they made it sound like anyone who'd opposed the plan was a child killer at heart, and less than a human being. They told us that this plan would achieve a noble idea. Well, how were we to know otherwise? Hadn't we heard it all our lives, from our parents and our school teachers and our ministers, and in every newspaper we ever read, in every movie, in every public speech? Hadn't we always been told that this was righteous and just? Well, maybe there's some excuse for what we did at that meeting. Still, we voted for the plan, and what we got, we had it coming to us. You know, ma'am, we are marked men in a way, those of us who lived through the 4 years of that plan in the 20th century factory. What is it that hell is supposed to be? Evil. Plain, naked, smirking evil, isn't it? Well, that's what we saw and helped to make, and I think we're damned, every one of us, and maybe we'll never be forgiven. You know how it worked, that plan, and what it did to people? Try pouring water into a tank where there's a pipe at the bottom, draining it out faster than you pour it, and each bucket you bring breaks that pipe an inch wider, and the harder you work, the more is demanded of you, and you stand slinging buckets 40 hours a week, then 48, then 56, for your neighbor's supper, for his wife's operation, for his child's measles, for his mother's wheelchair, for his uncle's shirt, for his nephew's schooling, for the baby next door, for the baby to be born, for anyone, anywhere around you. It's theirs to receive from diapers to dentures, and yours to work from sun up to sundown, month after month, year after year, with nothing to show for it but your sweat, with nothing in sight for you but their pleasure, for the whole of your life, without rest, without hope, without end. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. We're all one big family, they told us. We're all in this together. But you don't all stand working at acetylene torch 10 hours a day, together. And you don't all get a bellyache, together. What's whose ability? And which of whose needs comes first? When it's all in one pot, you can't let any man decide what his own needs are, can you? If you did, he might claim that he needs a yacht. And if his feelings is all you have to go by, he might prove it, too. Why not? If it's not right for me to own a car until I've worked myself into a hospital ward, earning a car for every other loafer and every naked savage on earth, why can't he demand a yacht from me, too, if I still have the ability not to have collapsed? No? He can't?